So welcome everyone, still first day of Marxism Conference, this session about the limitations and politics of call-out culture. My name's Jade, I'm going to be helping chairing and facilitating this session. I'm an activist at Melbourne Uni, so just up the road from here. And Harsha is going to be giving us a little introduction. Harsha, for people who don't know, she's an activist at Sydney Uni. She's also the National Union of Students National Ethno-Cultural Officer. The National Union of Students is the key and peak student union body in Australia. And so as National Ethno-Cultural Officer, it's Harsha's job to try and organise campaigns around and standing up to racism and inequality and taking a stand against the repulsive racist attitudes that the Australian government has. And she's been doing a fantastic job of it this year. Harsha is going to speak for around half an hour, and then we'll have plenty of time for comments, questions, thoughts, and discussion. So if people have been in sessions earlier today, you'll know how it runs by now. When the speakers finish, people can just put up their hands and I'll call a couple of people, and we can have a bit of a discussion about what they said. So make Harsha feel welcome.
Thanks, guys, and thanks, Jade. I thought I'd just get a bit of a sense of familiarity of people in the room with the term call-out culture. Who has a kind of working definition of what call-out culture is? Like, if I could have a straw poll, that'd be great. Yep, so quite a few. Yeah, excellent. I thought I'd still go over, in that case, what is call-out culture, a definition of it, I think, for starters. So it's primarily an internet phenomenon. It's the condemnation, usually very public, incurred by somebody for speaking from a privileged standpoint in ignorance of their own perceived advantage. And this is usually about questions of oppression, so like racism, sexism, oppression on the basis of gender. And really, sometimes the topics that are written about and critiqued are about oppression, but sometimes it's only tangentially related. They're often just commentary pieces about life experience that get picked apart relentlessly on the internet. And calling out can actually be directed at a number of different targets. Sometimes it's applied to the elite or specifically members of the ruling class that say heinous things. But more often, actually, and I guess this is why this is a phenomenon that has limits, is that it's applied to people in activist or otherwise progressive circles, people who are interested, actually, in fighting against oppression. And call-outs can be used differently by different people. They can be left-wing, especially when they are directed at people in positions of power. But I think it can be less meaningfully directed at random individuals that are said to embody some privilege. And as a complete strategy for challenging oppression, however, calling out privilege as a method for challenging oppression, I think, is fundamentally flawed. I think I'll just throw some examples to illustrate some of the different types of call-outs and the distinctions that I've just gone over. For example, this is a very commonplace example. The internet left called out an individual who held a Mexican-themed party in a college dorm in America with Mexican food and salsa dancing for being culturally appropriative and therefore insensitive to Mexican people. And I think that's a quite trivial example of call-out culture, but actually one of the most common ways that the privilege call-out manifests. And I think the triviality of it is important. It doesn't begin to touch on the world of oppression that exists outside the behaviour of individuals who want to have some fun holding a Mexican-themed party. Another example quite recently was the 2016 Democratic Party primaries in the US, which I know a number of people in the room followed. Where there was a contest between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And actually the primaries and also the presidential election itself abounded with privileged call-outs. One example was people calling out supporters of Bernie Sanders, bizarrely, as being privileged. And there was an accusation thrown around a lot of people who supported Bernie Sanders as being Bernie bros. That is, that they embodied male privilege that desired the defeat of a female candidate a candidate, which is a heinous crime. They were also said to embody the privilege of having a pure, principled, left-wing idea at the expense of female achievement. And Sanders supporters were privileged because they were willing at least to tolerate a Trump victory, which would be harmful for the least privileged people in society, immigrants, trans people, etc., black people. And for example, and a really great, or pretty weird actually, example of that is this Guardian headline that was "Bernie Sanders or bust." That's a stance based on privilege. And it was actually mostly Clinton supporters that, that did this, surprise, surprise. And they did it because they wanted to defend right-wing politics that of Clinton, actually, on the basis that she was a woman. So that she was, that even though she is a conservative, a small-c conservative, that she was somehow the more progressive choice because she is a woman, embodies this identity or category, whereas Bernie Sanders is a privileged old white man. There's also the example of people who called out Clinton herself for being privileged, and I think that that's a correct criticism. For example, Tony Brasunas in one of the American online magazines said, wrote an article called "Please Recognise Your Privilege If You Can Afford 8 Years of Hillary Clinton and the Status Quo." And I think that that's correct because Clinton is privileged in the real sense of the word. She has been part of the political apparatus in America for an extremely long time. She is a multi-millionaire and she's made money because she speaks in the interests of Wall Street, who roll her candidacy. And it was mostly the left that called out Clinton in response to her own use of the term privilege. And I think it's a valid critique because she's a neoliberal and she desires to cover that neoliberal politics with a recognition of white privilege. Another commentator tweeted that it takes a position of incredible privilege to think you should vote based on meaningless social signalling rather than on actual policy. And although the right also did this, they also called out Clinton for being privileged. For example, saying that you know, she's a very privileged individual, and that's why you should support Trump because he stands for ordinary people. That's obviously a garbage position, but I think nevertheless the left was right to point out that Clinton is an extremely privileged individuals. In fact, the subsequent commentary coming out of the election is that anti-Trump lefties are privileged because they care about questions of a social nature, like questions about gender, race, and that kind of thing, and they don't defend enough blue-collar workers who are scared about immigrants stealing their jobs. That's an obviously right-wing position, the position that says that inner city liberals have abandoned the white working class to globalisation. I think that that is something as well that is a problem with this kind of politics, which is that it can be used by both the left and by the right. I think the call-out phenomenon is part of a broader set of politics called privilege politics. And I think this is probably a term that a lot of people in the room have heard before. So what is privilege politics? I think this is more than just the commonly understood definition of privilege as being a descriptor for those with wealth and power in society. It's more than that. It's a framework for for explaining all different kinds of oppression. It sees the world in terms of the multiplicity of oppressions that you either have or you don't have. And it posits those that don't have the oppression in question as being privileged. A corollary of this is that those who are privileged have privilege over those people who are oppressed because of the unearned advantages they enjoy that the oppressed don't. Therefore, the source of oppression are those who are privileged. Their mentality maintains oppression. On the face of this, this seems to describe reality, but I think that there are plenty of problems with this framework for understanding oppression. For starters, I think there's much to question in the use of the term privilege outside its original meaning, connoting wealth and power, to describe the possession of basic rights, actually, that human beings should always be afforded. For example, I think it's not a privilege necessarily. In fact, I don't think it's a privilege not to be shot while walking in your neighbourhood while wearing a hoodie. But proponents of privilege theory suggest that black people in the US are underprivileged and white people are privileged for not having to face that that daily threat of violence. The very framework posits human rights as an advantage rather than a standard below which some groups, unfortunately, in this society find themselves. Moreover, you know, to what extent really is a homeless white person privileged over somebody like Obama, a rich black person? I think privilege is a very abstract scheme which often ignores the dimension of wealth. Therefore, I think privilege for the left isn't actually a useful term if it describes what the author Phoebe Maltz-Bovey calls all forms of relative advantage. I think in this framework, there's no space for explaining the often vast political differentiation in either the privileged group or the oppressed group. For example, it can't explain why there exist conservative black people like, do you guys remember Ben Carson, the surgeon turned catastrophic failure Republican presidential candidate? And it can't explain why there, throughout the whole history of anti-racist fights, there have been white people who have actually risked everything, including their lives, to fight alongside black people in the struggle against their oppression. And the reality is that privilege politics doesn't explain even why some people are oppressed and others are not. It describes the surface appearance of oppression, which appears to operate between individuals at a systemic level, rather than being tied to the material structures of society. And it ascribes permanence to these relationships. Oppression simply exists as an eternal fact due to the mentality of the privileged who dominate. Furthermore, because it can't explain the purpose of privilege, it can be unclear and malleable who is privileged and who isn't. And this is the problem that I mentioned earlier in relation to all of the different privilege call-outs that happened during the 2016 presidential elections in the US. Is that the right can use a privilege framework as well in order to attack the idea that we should care at all about the oppression of women or the oppression of LGBTI people. And at worst, in this framework, individual members of a privileged group have no agency whatsoever to change their ideas in response to political argument. And this is in contrast to the common liberal idea, actually, that an individual has an independent moral will, which of course is flawed because society does have an impact on consciousness, but nor is there potential for ideas to shift in response to developments in society. And that's because the mentality of privilege will inevitably assert itself even when a member of the privileged group support the oppressed. Privilege is described as basically operating on a psychological level. And this is a very pessimistic view, as it basically means individuals can't ever, ever escape a privileged mindset. And as a consequence of this pessimism, privilege politics doesn't suggest any action that can actually help undermine oppression. Because the division between privileged and oppressed is assumed to be timeless, the most that can be done is to try and recognise and be self-aware as an individual of the privilege that otherwise goes hidden. However, in the history of the world, probably not just of capitalism, education and enlightenment alone have never been enough to challenge oppression alone, let alone get rid of it. Overall, the focus on individual relationships between those who experience a particular kind of oppression and those who don't tends to direct people away from the social solidarity that's needed to beat oppression, but I want to say more about this at the end. I want to discuss briefly why has this politics become so popular, because it hasn't always been the case that this has been so dominant. There have been discussions of male or white privilege since the rise of the New Left in the 60s, which have often focused themselves on questions of oppression. But it really only took off as a framework for explaining oppression in general in a later context. And that context is a sad one, an unfortunate one for the left. It's the decline in social movements and class struggle as society went into the 80s. They were hammered by, ordinary people were hammered by economic crisis, and the weakness in the left, particularly in the US, meant that that could not be combated. It's the rise of neoliberal ideology promoted by the ruling class, which was actually accepted by whole sections of the left. An attendant was a dynamic in which left or progressive thinking was not carried out in the movement. The movements, as they stood, largely didn't exist, but predominantly in the halls of academia by middle-class writers, and reflected, therefore, the class concerns of middle class rather than the mass of impoverished black people or working-class people or women, etc. And now there's a whole industry, actually, of academic studies, commentary, cultural criticism, personal memoirs, and teaching aids that centre on recognising privilege. And I think the originator of this understanding is a woman called Peggy McIntosh. She was an academic. She still is, sorry. Her short piece, Unpacking the Invisible Backpack, White Privilege, from 1989, is the best illustration of it. It lists a whole series of ways that she, as a white woman, is privileged. Certain fixtures of this work are indicative of this overall trend. She focuses on the ways that the privileged individual is equipped with special provisions, maps, passports, code books, visas, clothes, tools, and blank checks in an invisible, weightless backpack for interactions with other individuals. The privilege checklist is a way for McIntosh to work on myself, note the kind of individualised, atomised kind of framework that's actually a consequence of neoliberal ideology. Actually, 8 of the 26 privileges listed are concerned with issues solely of representation rather than substantive inequalities. And instead, that reflects the turn away from critiquing the structures of inequality and instead focusing on issues of culture or representation within the state. If it posits a strategy for confronting privilege, it's only to educate the privileged and to ask them to give up their invisible backpack. The privilege checklist is a way, as I said, working on yourself, educating individuals, rather than struggle and activism, because at that point in time, it wasn't really on the agenda in the US. Individual acts can palliate, she says, but cannot end these problems. So there's no action that individuals can take who are privileged to stand with the oppressed or end the dominance conferred at birth. There's a real pessimism about the potential for change. The sights have really been lowered since the prevailing discourse of liberation that was talked about last night in the opening night of the conference that dominated in the late 60s. Peggy McIntosh, like I said, she's an academic, she's not an activist, and prior to writing this piece, was a teacher at Brearley School, a private all-girls school in the exclusive clime of Upper East Side Manhattan. Within the privileged politics tent, there are specific problems with calling out as a phenomenon as well. So I guess finally getting to the title of the talk. Their functions in circles that accept this framework are a set of rules about behaviour and language, which can be hard for people just getting involved to kind of navigate. The price, however, of messing up, saying the wrong thing, using the incorrect terminology, is to be permanently branded as racist or sexist, and that's a product of your unremitting privilege. This can only function to limit progressive politics to an exclusive set that gets it, rather than broaden participation in a movement and educate people through involvement in the struggle. And as privilege-checking critic Phoebe Maltz-Bovey points out, there's a vocabulary of privilege that is actually the province of attendees of liberal arts colleges and the otherwise well-to-do. She describes it as a new kind of noblesse oblige. I don't know how to speak French. And a new social code for those that actually do have power and privilege in this society. And actually a consequence of this kind of phenomenon is an authoritarian dimension. It's really a perfect storm when there's a disagreement with an individual on a political basis in these progressive circles. And instead of taking up in this political manner, an individual can be called out on the basis of some privilege that they have and therefore totally discredited. The same can occur when there's only a petty grievance rather than any political disagreement whatsoever, which again is incredibly unhelpful for building movements against oppression. in which, in general, it's better for debates to be actually had out and ideas tested on the basis of whether they're useful in taking progressive politics forward, not instead of people being censored on the basis of a privilege that they supposedly have. As with privilege politics in general, calling out is limited to drawing attention to privilege rather than suggesting any action that can remedy oppression. Calling out becomes an end in and of itself. Privilege checking is to ask the accused to own up to privilege, not to do anything about it, and to appear self-aware and grateful, in the words of Phoebe Motsbobi. So I think there are a number of critiques of call-out culture. It's existed for a little while now. I think probably in the last 5 years it's become quite ubiquitous on the internet. So I just wanted to take you through a few critiques of call-out culture that come from the internet world, and then end with a Marxist critique of call-out culture. So there is actually a right-wing critique of call-out culture. Essentially, these are conservative college students or professors that dismiss concern for the oppressed in general and consider it outrageous that they themselves have been targeted for being conservative. So an example of this is the infamous Tal Fortgang. He wrote a piece, "Why I'll Never Apologise for My White Male Privilege." you can imagine that that'd be a barrel of laughs to read. Fortgang believes that judging him collectively as a white man toes the line of racism, bit of a nice accusation of reverse racism there, and accuses the campus left of diminishing everything I have personally accomplished. He's a classic conservative snowflake. I think he got into Princeton. I think that's his big achievement. And he also calls the American meritocracy, accuses people of calling the American meritocracy a myth, which obviously stings him very deeply. There's also a conservative student cited in Connor Friedersdorf's Atlantic article, "The Destructiveness of Call-Out Culture on Campus," who's concerned about the lefty hive mind on campus, on which he's about as common as an albino snapping turtle. Weird analogy. He laments a situation where there can't be civil debate and his conservative views are respected and listened to. "My views, if shared, would be labelled racist, fascist, nationalist," he laments. Probably true. Genuine Marxists have no truck with people. I think it should be quite obvious, who are scornful or otherwise indifferent to questions of oppression. And their critique of privilege call-outs is actually just gross apologism for their right-wing politics. There is, however, a kind of more serious critique of call-out culture that comes from a kind of liberal left kind of circles. And there's two distinct strands for this. And I think there's one that's kind of more right-wing. There are those who are defensive about their genuinely quite right-wing positions being contested. And for example, Phoebe Motsbobi, who I've quoted numerous times throughout this talk, herself actually has a number of right-wing positions that inform her critique of call-out culture. She's actually a Clinton supporter on the basis of the very kind of politics that I critiqued earlier, that because she's a woman, that therefore she deserves to be supported, even though in the opinion of Marxists, that's probably the only thing that she's got going for her. Even though she's sympathetic to Sanders, elements of Sanders' platform, she still maintains this. And to dismiss this position on the basis of Clinton's abundant privilege and her insufficiently left politics, according to Bobi, is sinister because it is indifferent to female success and puts that there is nothing remotely progressive about gender equity at the top. Moreover, Clinton experiences misogyny herself, true, so it's wrong to place her at the point of tippy-top privilege. The quest of privilege politics is to support only the most marginalised, according to Bobi, assumes that sexism is a finished issue and somehow bourgeois. And she says, "How can the need for a female president have become obsolete before we have even had one?" She also advocates, as part of this, for the promotion of high-flying careers of identity, oppressed identity categories like women or black people, what she calls calling around as a replacement for call-out culture. But I think as left-wing people, we've got to say that gender equity at the top of society, or racial equity at the top of society, is clearly inadequate for remedying the problems of oppression that exist in this world. And it's it ends up defending people, this position, who are truly privileged in the class sense of the word, like privilege. Sorry, like Clinton. I'm just getting those things are quite synonymous these days, Clinton and privilege. And who, moreover, you know, she has a right-wing vision of what society should look like, and she actually has the power to enforce that vision as well, being a member of the ruling class. There's another right-wing critique of call-out culture, which is that it's too nasty and too mean. And perhaps call-out culture is the inevitable result of young people being online and all the viciousness that ensues. No distinction is really made between calling out and bullying. So Connor Friedersdorf, who I mentioned earlier in his article, he concludes that call-out culture is little more than destructive bullying. Similarly, in his article about the Halloween costumes debacle at Yale that people might be aware of, he laments that the campus left displays flagrant intolerance and lacks nuance. You've probably been told that you lack nuance before if you're a left-wing person. That they lack nuance in their approach to this matter, and that the ability to tolerate offence are hallmarks of a free and open society, which is obviously a very right-wing critique of the campus left rather than constructive criticism, because it presumes that all ideas about society and about oppression are equally valid, which, if you care about oppression and ending it, that's clearly not the case. The problem in Friedersdorf's eyes is that the intolerant left can't engage in respectful debate. Others suggest that if call-out culture is divisive and its moralistic outrage unhelpful, perhaps calling in is a solution. Calling in is instead approaching individuals privately, explaining what was wrong with their behaviour and asking them to rectify it. A writer says that by constantly calling out, we lose all compassion for each other, and instead we need to be willing to offer compassion and patience as a way to build the road we're taking but have never seen before. Calling in, I think, is obviously a more patient way of building a progressive movement, since rather than ostracising people who belong to a particular privileged group, or people who don't know the terminology around oppression, it aims to educate and include people who want to fight. However, calling in doesn't actually address the underlying problems with call-out culture. The problem isn't just the tone or the method of delivery, but the expectation that tirades against individuals who are seen as privileged will somehow overcome oppression. And on a slightly separate note, actually, the legitimate anger that people have against oppression is not a problem. In fact, there should be more of it. Compassion alone will not combat the right, and we shouldn't really be bothered about hurting the feelings of right-wingers, I think. Challenging right-wing opinions about oppression, although not the end of the story, is actually important, and we can't hope to convince the right of our point of view simply by engaging in that kind of respectability politics that Friedersdorf demands of us. Then there are actually very helpful contributions on the whole from the kind of left of this kind of liberal circles, from those who think that it's calling out is unhelpful for the movement, though they otherwise agree with the analytical framework of privileged politics, which of course I think is a limitation. For example, progressive writer Assam Ahmad is more on the money in his note on call-out culture. He calls it an armchair and academic brand of activism, a public performance where people can demonstrate their wit or how pure their politics are, putting people outside the community if they dare to put a foot wrong. He understands as well that it is necessary to challenge harmful behaviours and right-wing opinions. He acknowledges that some call-outs are necessary where there is a power differential involved in forming prejudice. He also thinks that there should be no demand that these call-outs be polite on the part of the oppressed. And Ahmad is right to say that it is illusory to pretend that everyone's voice is equally heard in society. However, in his critique, it's unclear who qualifies as being in a powerful and privileged position. Is it a member of the political elite like Clinton, or is it just like a random person like your white neighbour? He accepts the framework of privileged politics, but his focus at least talks about real action that can confront the enormity of oppression that exists in this society. I'll just skip over that example because I got a little bit behind. So just now, I guess, to bring it all together, there's been a lot of critiquing going on, but as Marxists, we don't just critique, we actually have a way of explaining oppression and how to fight it. And I think this is a critique of the whole framework of privilege as being inadequate for doing just that, understanding oppression. It's, I guess, a framework for trying to understand it, but moreover, trying to get rid of oppression entirely. And for that, we say that oppression has a definite source, that is capitalism. The source of oppression is the material structure of capitalism, not just the bad attitudes of all individuals who find themselves without that particular kind of oppression. Oppression on the basis of race, gender, and sexuality is built into the institutions of capitalist society in order to prop up a fundamentally an unequal world setup. This suggests, of course, a course of action to combat oppression through struggle against those capitalist institutions, and in particular, mass movements that have the potential to bring them down. This is in contrast to the strategy of privilege education, which cannot undermine oppression as it is rooted in the structures of capitalist society, not in the human mind. It also contrasts with the atomized nature of the call-out, which comes from an understanding of privilege as a relationship between individuals rather than a social relationship. Also, political differences within the oppressed group and the non-oppressed group do matter for Marxists. Within the Aboriginal community, for example, and I know Gavin, who spoke on opening night, has a lot to say about this, there are actually advocates of punitive welfare systems, people who deny the re-emergence of a new stolen generation of Indigenous people put into out-of-home care. While there are also those many more who think that every racist institution in Australian capitalist society should be torn down. Obviously, one of these groups is much more important to the fight for Aboriginal rights than the other. In fact, class is the biggest determinant of politics. The most right-wing people in our society are those who rule over it. Their divisive ideas on race, gender, sexuality, etc. are directly in their class interests. And empirically, it's actually been found that the most oppressive attitudes are concentrated in the highest income postcodes in my current place of residence, Sydney, like Mossman. That's why, in the example of the Aboriginal community, it's always those Aboriginal people who've left the communities that they grew up in, especially those who are capitalists or participate in the running of capitalist institutions like the legal system or in the police, etc., who have the most right-wing attitudes about even the oppression of their own Indigenous people. Conversely, the group usually recognised as being the most privileged, white men, contains many who are sensitive to questions of oppression. Some, in fact, are able to, if you can believe it, understand it in a highly sophisticated manner. And often this has been through their involvement in struggle. For this factor, really, the deeper the struggle, the better, as well as a political commitment, actually, to human liberation. Marxists understand that consciousness is not static. Ideas can and do change. The privileged mentality is not innate and psychological, but constructed and surmountable. There is a correlation between being on the lower rungs of the ladder in the working class and having more left-wing attitudes on questions of oppression. However, this isn't a direct causation because there are always workers whose consciousness reflects the ideas of the ruling class who have actually every means of promoting their ideas throughout society in order to help them rule it. This section of the working class can be larger or smaller at different points in history, but the important thing is that the way that those ideas change and that section is enlarged is through struggle, their involvement in working class struggle, together of the oppressed and those who stand in solidarity with them. That's what increases the forces on our side and diminishes the hold of oppressive ruling ideas. Marxists, of course, are in no way in favour of the crass paternalism in which often middle-class allies of the oppressed speak on the behalf of those they only see as victims. We recognise that the oppressed themselves are usually at the forefront of the struggle of the fight against their own oppression. But the ideas of any participants in mass movements can change drastically, even those belonging to so-called privileged groups. And this is key to a Marxist understanding of how change can come about and how we can eliminate oppressive ideas forever.